Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 170 of Registry Matters. Larry, tell me what you think about daylight savings before, after. Does it mess you up? Do you think we should have it? Tell me what you think about daylight savings time.
Well, you know, interesting that that bill was debated in the legislature. It has been for years, and I'm not even sure if it made it to the finish line. But we have a New Mexican in chat, and he can probably look it up and tell me. It was one of Senator Cliff Pirtle's bills. And I know it got passed the Senate, but I don't know if the House put it in. But in my personal opinion, I really don't care. I heard these arguments that it would, it messes the cows up, and I'm not sure the cows really look at the time. I'm thinking that their bodies produce milk in cycles, and I think the farmers would just adjust the dairy operators would just adjust their milking schedule. I can't imagine how it would disrupt the cows. But anyway,
I have never heard that before. Pretty sure that cows just operate based on wherever the heck the sun is, not when the farmer comes out. That would be my guess, but I am certainly no farmer. I'm a computer guy, not a cow guy.
So, well, yes.
The similarities, they both start with C's.
But anyway, since we have a listener in chat, he can go to the website and see if Pirtle's daylight savings bill passed or if it stalled out in the House side.
I would just personally prefer it get darker later at night. So now at East Coast, it's getting dark. I mean, I had to put my blackout curtains up to keep the video from looking funky. But if the sun goes down now, here it is in March, it's like around 7:30, almost 8 o'clock that it goes down. I really like that much better. I don't like it going down at 5. It's not fun to me.
Well, I think we've mentioned this before in the embargo days in 73, 74, they did try year round daylight savings time, and then they repealed it, the Congress did, because of the darkness in the morning that was made children vulnerable to car accidents. So we have tried year round.
But the kids up the street from me, they go stand out for the school bus at zero dark 30 also. Like, even the wintertime, it's dark. I don't see what the difference of dark at 6 a.m. versus less dark at 6 a.m. Like, it's dark. I don't get it.
Well, you got to remember, a lot has improved since 73. We had those old mercury vapor lights on the streets where you had lights in those days. As they age, they got dimmer and dimmer. Then the headlights on cars were those round bulbs. Everybody had the same headlight, so the lighting on vehicles was not near as good. We didn't have the detection devices on vehicles that would the hazard. I mean, there was so much different in 73. Probably fewer crossing guards. There were, it's a different era. So what was dangerous then might not be nearly as dangerous. I doubt they had the reflective clothing. Kids have shoes nowadays that have lights that constantly flash.
Yeah, they have LED lights in them. Sure.
much has changed since 73.
All right. Tell me about the agenda. Oh, wait. Sorry. Hang on. Let me press this button. Make sure that you go to YouTube and like and subscribe and share it with all of your friends, family, and neighbors. And also do so in your favorite podcast app. So tell me about the agenda for the night, Larry.
Well, we have an action-packed, jammed agenda tonight. We're gonna take some questions from inside, behind the walls. We're going to take some from outside the walls. We're going to talk about legislative action in my state. We're going to talk about an appeal that's pending in Georgia regarding Halloween signs. I mean, we're going to really fill this thing up. We got some stories to talk about, some news articles, and it should be jam packed. We got to move fast.
Did you tell me something about some crazy legislature going on in the New Mexico House of something? The House bill, we talked about it. House Bill 56.
Yes, we did talk about that.
Did the legislature adjourn today at high noon?
They did. That's in the Constitution. So they adjourned today at high noon, and that House Bill 56, which was the human trafficking and the SORNA changes, it stalled out in the Senate.
Interesting. Describe that again. It started as a House, and then it goes over to the Senate, and then could you go over that just real quick again?
Yeah, so since it has an HB number, that means it was introduced in the House. And the House passed it as we fully anticipated. The House, those members have to face the wrath of the angry mob every 2 years. And the pressure was on them immense, enormous, immense pressure on them to pass this human trafficking. Jeffrey Epstein closed the SORNA loophole for out-of-state people. So we concentrated on LJC, the Liberty and Justice Coalition. We concentrate our efforts on the Senate because they don't have to face the angry mob for almost 4 years, and we cooler heads prevail in the Senate, and we were able to convey the problems with the legislation, and the sponsors weren't really on the House side willing to make any changes, so therefore the bill died. It didn't gain any traction in the Senate.
Okay. I was watching the Narsal affiliates list, and something passed up last week from Ohio, and may I read something to you?
Sure, I think I know what you're talking about.
So it reads, it says, I just learned from our Hamilton County, Ohio prosecutors asking for the names of all those removed from the registry in that county. He apparently feels that holding in Willman versus U.S. Attorney General justifies penalties for many of them for registration violations under the federal SORNA. The Sixth Circuit ruled that the obligations to register under SORNA is independent of any duties under state law. Therefore, even those who have been removed under state law may be subject to charges of failure to register. Is anyone else running into this, especially in the Sixth Circuit? One of my colleagues asked me how a state prosecutor has jurisdiction over what is a federal claim under Willman. This could potentially affect every PFR who has timed out under Megan's Law, since SORNA requires the law be applied retroactively. Can federal legislation override a ruling from our state Supreme Court? Do you people have any thoughts? This is complicated. There's a lot of words in there.
So yes, I'm familiar with this. We talked about this Willman case at some episodes back, and I wrote a piece that was posted on Narsal's website about Willman and the dangers in the case. But here's the reality: a prosecuting attorney, a state prosecuting attorney, cannot prosecute for federal crimes. So we can rule out the Hamilton County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. They will not be able to file any charges. Now, they could go to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the same jurisdiction and say, Mr. or Madam U.S. Attorney, we believe that based on Willman that these people have an independent duty to register, and we believe that you should prosecute them under federal law. And I do not for a moment buy into to this misguided notion that the federal prosecutors are overworked and understaffed and all that kind of stuff. That's not true. But I do buy into one thing about federal prosecutors: they like to win, and they do not like to ride sinking ships. And they would take a look at the case law in Ohio that interpreted the Ohio, since there's only Ohio registry, there really isn't a federal registry. And in that regard, I think the panel was wrong in the Willman case. So I do not think it's very likely that a U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney in general, would bring those charges. Now, having said that, then the question is there a workaround? Yes, there is. There absolutely is. If I were the Hamilton County prosecuting attorney, I would get together with the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and I would tell them that we need to just do a slight amendment in our Ohio statutory scheme. And that amendment would be that there would be a duty to register pursuant to federal law. So I would and expand the definition of Ohio law to include anyone who's defined as a sexual offender pursuant to the Adam Walsh Child Safety Act of 2006. And then that would wind up a brand new round of litigation, because if I were a defense attorney for anybody that the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuted, if that law were to become enacted, I would come back in and I would argue that there is no federal registry, and that the Ohio Constitution is supreme, and that the courts of Ohio have ruled that the Ohio Constitution prohibits anybody from having additional obligations imposed on them. So this could get quite interesting, and it could get quite fascinating for those legal beagles out there, but this was all predictable. that this would happen.
Do me a favor and back up on one thing that you said. I was just going to ask you this organically. It's like, could you remind us that there is slash is not a federal registry? And where is my federal registration office?
Well, people mistake the Drew Shadeen website where each of the territorial and state registries are accessible through one search engine, and they mistake that for being a federal registry, but there isn't. And some people mistake the fact that when you are registered by the various jurisdictions, they entered you into the National Crime Database. That's one of the person files in the NCIC. But that's still not a federal registry. The registration obligation is what's imposed by your state statutory scheme. So that's where the problem lies for these people in Hamilton County. There is no federal registry. So if the Ohio courts continue to maintain that you cannot do this, it violates our Ohio Constitution, the feds will just have to pound sand.
Love that expression. I love that expression. Go pound sand. Because it does. People, I think even you run into attorneys that adamantly say that there's some sort of federal registry out there.
Yes, I know a number of them that do that, and it's unfortunate. I mean, the courts really don't understand it. That's how the Willman decision was able to be handed down. I mean, we have confused judges, and my fear, I think Willman files were cert, and I was intending to check before we went live today to see if that petition has been decided, but he had asked the U.S. Supreme Court for a review. And in my mind, it would be very dangerous if they reviewed the case, because I'm not convinced that the Supreme Court would get it right either, because they may find themselves in a confused posture to think there's a federal registry when there isn't.
So weird. You don't have any idea. Do you think it's just, you said that Drew Shadeen, which is the name of a person, Drew, and then there's no way I'm ever going to be able to pronounce that last name. But do you think that that's just the origin of all of it? Or is there something else that people are so confused that there's a federal registry?
Well, they're confused because there was a demand for a federal registry because of the high level of noncompliance back in the mid 2000s. It was reported that 100,000 of what was about 500,000 at that time had exempted themselves by just simply not complying and moving across state lines. And mm-hmm. They realized they could not federalize the registry because they didn't have the jurisdictional hook to do that. These people largely have been convicted of state offenses.
Right.
And it's like when you register your car, you're not registering with a federal registrar, because your car is registered in the state of Georgia, whatever state that you're in. And so there was no jurisdiction. So the only way that they could try to gain a jurisdictional hook was by the power of budgeting. And so they asked the states, would you please do this in our national interest to have this registry where they more resemble one another, and where they communicate with one another. The registries prior to 2006 were largely independent of one another. And so now they've got a whole lot more networking, but there is no federal registry. But there was the hope by the Congress that the registries would more mirror one another, and that would make it more easy to comply. But they have not grown more like one another. Each state has continued to try to compete to make sure that they're the toughest.
Right.
So we still don't have anything that resembles a uniform law. And after I realized what had gone wrong, I even worked towards trying to get a uniform law, because uniform laws are adopted all the time by the states working together. And they adopt them as a uniform law. There's a commission on that, but the Uniform Law Commission was not interested because the process was too far along with what was going on now. And they weren't going to step into something that was this controversial and try to write a uniform law when the Adam Walsh Act was already on the books by the time I got around. It was like 3-4 years after the Adam Walsh Act passed that it dawned on me that what we really were searching for was a uniform law. And that would mean that all the states would have, you would gain no advantage of going from one state to the other. But that would, the difficulty in uniform law is that the states that are so horrendously hard are not going to want to come down.
Yes.
Because they would see that that as being soft on you know what, PFRs. And the sure. states that are moderately reasonable, there's a few of them that still are, they would have to come up. Mm-hmm. And they would have to increase their requirements. And of course, if you happen to be in one of those states that had to raise and increase their requirements, you would not find a uniform law to be all that popular.
I'll make somewhat of a general observation is that I think that states, just sort of like their neighbors, are very similar to each other across the border, like taxes and driving regulations. They're similar. I know that you're going to end up with this like one state that's some sort of pocket that's a crazy, you can drive 100 miles an hour in the middle of nowhere, and then the states around you, you can't do that. But I bet you you would find that the states are similar to the one that are that's next to it.
Well, at least there are people who advocate in legislative bodies for that similarity. All you have to do is look at your recent example in Georgia, where the representative or senator, whichever it was, he said that we need to be more like the surrounding states in terms of the removal process. We're making it too easy. Right. You remember that? So that shows that they were looking at the surrounding states.
Sure. All right, we should move on. We've been hanging around this for too long, but it's good information because people bringing this up, and then we can talk about the Federal Registry, which doesn't exist. Shall we move on, sir?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, this came from Reddit. It says, just discovered you people and the podcast through Reddit. I'm glad to hear someone taking aim at a situation that affected me over a decade ago. My parole date from Penitentiary of New Mexico was September 18th, 2008. At that point, they had denied 3 parole plans for being too close to a school. They went on to deny one more for the same reason, and then a 5th that we found it in the middle of nowhere because it had inadequate cell phone service for active monitoring. I only had 1 year of parole, was on 50% good time, and was watching my poor mother try every avenue to find me suitable address. So I told her to stop and let me terminate my parole in-house. I was released March 3rd, 2009, upon termination of my parole, but still with 1 year of probation. I've reported directly to the same PO who had denied my parole plans, who told me to go find a place to live and come back the following day. I went to my 2nd parole plan, confirmed I could still live there. I had them pull it up on Google Maps and measure it, and found it to be over 2,000 feet from the nearest school. I printed that out and took it with me the next day, and when she said, "Oh, that's a bad address, it's too close to a school," I handed him the paper and he said, "Oh, okay." As though he just hadn't come across me hadn't cost me 6 extra months of incarceration. He also attempted to keep me on probation without giving me credit for the time served on my in-house parole. I had to print out and take him copies of my New Mexico, NMCD policy in order to be released from probation. What is it, the CD part?
Corrections
I don't know
department.
What the CD part is. Oh, Corrections Department. Okay. Gotcha. So the actual question is, now a decade later, I have lived and worked in both Colorado and Texas, both of which would provide a way to petition for removal from the registry had I been convicted in that state, but cannot because they must abide by New Mexico's ruling of lifetime registration for me. With New Mexico having no path off the registry until my death, what avenue can I take to support change in this? No one to speak to support any change in this because no one takes the time to understand it. The further along in my career I get, the more of an obstacle the registry becomes. No kidding. And it feels like there has to be something to be done about it eventually, but I'm at a loss. What advice can you give me? Convicted of 4th degree sexual exploitation, possession of CP in 2006. Thanks for all you do, FYP.
So, well, I can tell him there's so much in that. The national audience isn't really too concerned about the parole process in New Mexico, but so I'll just lightly gloss over. Parole doesn't come to a New Mexico prisoner until they've done their time. It would be more appropriately titled a period of supervised release. So in the time he was convicted, he was apparently under our old law before the treatment providers recommended that we have indeterminate periods of probation and parole for sexual offenses. And prior to that, the most you would have would be a 2-year parole period of a post-prison supervision. So he was able to go ahead and just serve his 1-year parole period in-house at 50% good time and walk away with just a probation. But the probation starts running the minute you get paroled because you're technically released and serving it in-house. So he's correct on all that, which nobody cares about. But what people do care about is the part of where he says he can't get off in Colorado. I do not know that to be the case. Colorado does not discriminate and distinguish between a person with an out-of-state conviction. So I would recommend that he contact a Denver area attorney named Colleen Kelly. Mm-hmm. If he's living in Colorado, and find out. Now, if you have more than one conviction within the same case, which it appears though he might, then that disqualifies you under Colorado law. Texas has, to my knowledge, the last time I looked at their statutory scheme, they do not have any tie to another state's. They do not have a provision in their law that says you have to register with the term of the state where you were convicted. If that does exist, I would appreciate if he would send that to us so that we'll know that. But what Texas has routinely done through the years is they take the position that if you would qualify under the federal definition, that you're not eligible for our release. So they've administratively decided that petitions were denied, and I do not know that they've actually put that in their statutory scheme, but they've administratively have decided that if you have a conviction in another state that would qualify you under the AWA definition of a sexual offender, that you're not eligible to be removed. So again, his best bet would probably be Colorado if he's living there. You can't petition in any state you're not living in because that's not what's causing you to register. So if he's living in Colorado, he could talk to Colleen. If he's living in Texas, I would like to see the statute in the language where it says it's tied to the other states because I don't believe that to be the case.
Okay. Is there anything else? That's a whole lot of word salad going on there too.
I hope we get to follow up with this. He might actually have something that we don't know because these statutes change every year. Legislatures have proposals, and if I spent the time researching all the statutory schemes, well, I would never get through the day. So if that has changed, I'd like to see it, but I don't believe it to be the case. I believe they're going to continue to say that because he's defined under AWA criteria that he can't be removed. But we'll see what he sends us back.
Okay. And then moving over, we received an email message that says, "Hello, my name is Mike and I'm from the state of South Carolina. First off, I want to say thank you guys. You're doing a great job every week. After listening last week about the difficulty of organizing and funding, I couldn't help but shake my head because you guys have the biggest fundraising tool in front of you. It's the state's own registries. You have addresses of thousands of potential donors and volunteers. I don't think it would cost too much for mailers. If political candidates can master this, I'm sure the same can be done here. The problem with trying to use social media is that most states' authorities have made blanket bans on social media, like this one, so it's very hard for someone like me to even get involved. Thanks as always." Boy, do I have a lot to say about this one. Do you want to start?
All righty. Yes, we have actually done what he's recommending, and it's a natural reaction when you come in fresh. I gave a, I think I was not the keynote. We don't call it keynote even now, but I did an opening remarks at an ARSL conference in 2012, and I posed the same question that he's posed here. But as we've experimented with that model, we've discovered that the response rate is very, very, very low in terms of, so if you send out 100 letters, if you get 2 to 3 responses, it's considered a successful mailing. So and it doesn't matter. We've done the left cock of our head, we've cocked it to the right, we've tilted it back, we've tilted it forward. We've done it from state to state, states that are sparsely populated. We've done it in states that are heavily populated. And we've done it in states that are very affluent, and we've done it in states that are very poor, like my state. And actually, I had a better success rate when we were doing that here in this sparsely populated, very poor state than some of the more affluent states like Maryland, for example, or Connecticut, for example, or Ohio, for example, where we've done this, Pennsylvania, for example. So we just don't find that that's an effective way. It does bring in a couple of people for every 100. You do get a few new names, but as far as it being a fundraising tool, no, that is, it is not an effective fundraising tool.
So even, I mean, I may I use a personal anecdote here of what I did in Georgia?
Sure.
I mean, I mailed out, I personally, I hand addressed, I ran them through a printer. We printed out, we organized with my state group to work out a letter and sent out, I personally sent out 300 letters, and I think I received a handful of phone calls and not one thing transpired from it. When you do something like that, you have to be prepared to handle the multitude of different kinds of calls. People aren't just going to call in and say, "Hi, how much do you need? I have my checkbook open. What would you like?" They're going to call in and say, "Can you direct me to an attorney to get off this garbage list?" And I don't know. So out of the response rate, you also then have a certain kind of response rate of people that are even interested to do anything beyond that.
Well, most people are more interested in their own situation, which is why
Yes.
they contact you. But there's a lot of doubt because of scams and stuff. They've never heard of the organizational name, so they what frequently happens is they take these letters to their registry office and ask them if it's a scam, and they provide a copy of them to the sheriff, to whoever registers them, and of course the sheriff encourages them not to get involved. They take them to their POs, they take them to their treatment providers, but we don't get the type of response that would be desirable. So that is really something that's been tried, and we wish it would yield results, but it really doesn't.
Very well. I think I can move that one back a couple clicks, and then let's move over to this one. It says, "Dear Larry and Andy, God, you know what? I really need to get some some kind of music, some soft sobbing music." It says, "I'm a new subscriber to both the Digest newsletter and the Registry Matters podcast transcript. I share your podcast transcripts, which is absolutely 100% what we are trying to get people to do, is when that thing goes into the institution, share it with everybody. Collect a couple stamps and soups from everybody and subscribe to it. It would be fantastic to get this information disseminated out. I share your podcast with many other PFRs here at RCI Prison, and we truly appreciate the relevant information you provide. Myself and six other PFRs have discussed the topics you talk about. And the two questions we have are, Larry, this one's for you. What does FYP mean in FYP Productions?"
Well, FYP is kind of like the initial in Harry S. Truman's middle name. It means just what it is, S. So we decided that we were going to name this FYP Education, and it stands for whatever you want it to stand for. He put his own idea, and actually it came up with a pretty good one. Tell people what he thought it might stand for.
Well, that was the PFRs. He didn't do FYP. He did PFRs.
Oh, okay.
That comes up. So FYP Productions. Yeah, means FYP Productions. And then, so what does PFR stand for? And I guess the suggestions are as of pedophiles, fornicators, and rapists, which is really kind of terribly terrible. But so what does PFR stand for? I've been asked this by every other person who reads these with me. We cannot figure out what PFRs. So I've been telling the other sex offenders that PFRs are persons forced to register. And so that's what PFR stands for. It's people forced to register.
And
Nothing.
you have to register on your state's sexual offense registry. So when you go
So
in, tell them you want to register your offense.
which you're not registering yourself, even though your name and all that other garbage gets associated with, but you're registering the offense that you committed.
That's correct.
Interesting. God, it was probably a year ago that someone suggested PFR stand for persons forced to register, and I actually kind of scoffed at it if I remember. I was like, that's stupid. And then I prefer to use the term a whole lot more than anything else.
Oh, I really like that, and I'm working my way through the sexual offense registry, and I understand the theory behind it, because the inference is that the person is currently offending, and of course that's not who you are. That's something you did, one event in your life, hopefully, but it doesn't describe, because they're registering you. They take your DNA. They take your picture. They take your fingerprints. It lists your address. I wish it were just an offense registry. I wish you could just go down and register the offense, but it's a little bit more to it than that.
There is a tad more to it than that. Thanks, guys, in inside the walls, man. You mean a lot to us, for real, because I know that I've been there, and I am anxious for you guys to get out, and I know that you are too. So stay strong, and we'll see you when you get out here. Moving right along, Mr. Larry, this one is written in like the lightest pen possible, but it is very good penmanship, which I appreciate because it makes it easier to read. But could you press down harder? It says, "Dear sir or madam, I am currently incarcerated in Missouri for failure to register as a PFR. My original charge is out of Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm charged as a tier three, which was illegally scored by the courts. I have been registering almost 16 years now. I have filed motions in court and all was denied. I need your help to get my voice heard in court. I need the new laws from Missouri and Arkansas," and I'm saying that intentionally wrong, "Arkansas, that can help me to get my name removed from the registering list. plus any other contacts that can help my voice be heard. I also would like your newsletter to be sent to me monthly by mail. My life has been put in danger by the states and courts for a long time. This matter is unconstitutional. The state cannot put a person's life in the public danger that they have done mine. Please send any information that will help me to be free from the, to the address below. Please and thank you. All right, Larry. Ding, ding. Go at it.
So this is a tragic situation, and it's what happens to so many people. They relocate from one jurisdiction to the other without thoroughly understanding what the consequences are going to be. And I've had so many tell me, well, I got convicted in this state, so my registration obligation is 10 years. And I say, nope, not the case. Now, he got convicted in Little Rock, which is a county in central Arkansas, capital Pulaski. And had he never left Arkansas, he would have been eligible after 15 years to petition in Pulaski County to be removed from the obligation to register. And Pulaski, to the extent there's a liberal part of Arkansas, has a significant termination rate of those people that file those petitions. They get off. And I know that because of my connections with Arkansas attorneys. But when he left the jurisdiction of Arkansas, he submitted himself to the jurisdiction of Missouri. And I did not, and we cannot go through all the nuances of what, because we'd have to know too much about his particular facts of his case and how to score it up with Missouri law. But whatever Missouri requires is what applies to him in terms of his registry obligations. Arkansas is now out of the picture. So if he were to file a petition in Pulaski County, the first thing the Pulaski County prosecuting attorney office would do is they would file a motion to dismiss that petition, saying that he's not being required to register because of Arkansas law. And therefore, he needs to take this matter to a Missouri court. And that would be their likely response. So Arkansas can't help him because his conviction's there, but he's not being required to register under Arkansas law. If you look at Arkansas's registry, if he were rated as a level 2 or above, you might find his name on there. If he's level 1, you shouldn't find his name on there. But if you find his name on there, it would say living out of state. Okay. And Arkansas is done with him. So now the question is, what can he do in Missouri? Well, he's got to be eligible to file a petition for removal in Missouri, which they do have. But unfortunately, it looks like that there are a lot of exclusions. So, for example, a Tier 3 category PFR must register for life unless they were adjudicated as a juvenile, which is consistent with AWA. Tier 3s are not allowed to process off. That is one of the checkoffs in the compliance, says Tier 3s are, in fact, life 4 times a year. So if you're a Tier 3 in Missouri, you're not eligible. Then let's go down the list. If the victim was a child under the age of 17 and the offense was adjudicated after 07, so we don't have that information. But then the one that's really going to knock him out, if the offense was not in Missouri. So based on his letter, he's not able to file. He's not eligible. Now, this would be an example of a teachable moment. Now, there would be some attorneys who would want to file a removal petition, even though by black letter law, he's not eligible. What you would file would be a petition for declaratory judgment in a case like this. And you would ask the Missouri court, which I don't know what they name their trial level courts, but you would ask a superior or circuit or district or whatever the trial, a general jurisdiction court is, you would ask that court to declare that as a citizen of Missouri, that you would have the same rights and expectations that a person who was convicted out of state should have the same rights once they became attached to Missouri. And you could only achieve that in a declaratory action. You would invoke the Constitution of Missouri. You'd look for the Equal Protection Clause. You'd cite to the Equal Protection Clause in the U.S. Constitution, and you would argue vehemently in that vehicle. If you were to file a petition for removal using this process, the judge would say, well, now let me get this straight. You were convicted in Arkansas, right? Yes. Okay, the black letter law says you're not eligible to file one of these petitions. Why are we here? If you were to file a petition for declaratory judgment, you'd be putting forth arguments that could be raised in that vehicle using that process, and you could expand the scope of the judicial examination. So that's why it's so important that you filed the right type of action. But let's go through this list. If you were ever required to register under the Adam Walsh Act, the Federal Sex Offender Registry, SORNA, this is straight off of Missouri's Sexual Offense Registry website. This is where I got these bullets. Or if you currently have a pending case or a prior case for failure to register. So it looks like to me that he has a prior case, because he's in prison for it now, of FTR, failure to register. So he's disqualified on the basis of that. It looks like that they could easily declare that he's required under the Adam Walsh Act criteria of a sexual offender. And since he's out of Missouri, I would see no hope in him filing a petition for removal. Now, remember, this is a non-legal opinion. This is my personal opinion, but I can read and I can reasonably understand what I'm reading. So therefore, the only hope I would see would be for him to file a petition for declaratory judgment and to make some constitutional claims, to assert those. Whether they will work or not, we don't know. The bad thing is, if he goes back to Arkansas now, if he files in Pulaski County, he has a conviction out of state. And if I'm the Pulaski County prosecuting attorney, I'm going to say, well, judge, you shouldn't release this guy, because during the time that he had left and lived in other states, he had difficulty complying. And we would be turning loose a tidal wave of risk on this community if we released him. That's what I would say. And if I can think of that, I'm quite sure they can think of that.
You would think, should I play the track now?
Sure.
Of course, now it doesn't. Oh my God, technology explodes on me, Larry, right when I need it, right? There. Right when I need it, it explodes.
Well, you can clip it back in.
I can. So. And I'm shaking my fist. Damn you, technology!
So.
And then we'll move on to the next thing. And you put this in the box to share. Would you like me to read the poem, Forgotten Walls?
Sure. This was just a heart tugging thing that I thought that he deserves some recognition, and it's a
very well. Are we going to give the full name?
No.
Okay. I will then clip these things out later. But it's a person named Jeremy. It says, "You cannot love from prison. You cannot know the way. Your little child's arms embrace you. They take that part away. They take away the friends, the family, that cause to fray most cherished ties. Too much time, excessive time, from inflated charges and PS lies? Judging judges without compassion, leave a spark of hope so small, as distance between each phone call grows behind forgotten walls. Sometimes the sadness of it all hits home. The more you're here, the more you'll see. When 162 inmates live together and you walk by those phones, and they're empty." There is truth in that part, Larry. I have seen banks of phones, and there's 100 people in there, and the phones are just like, they're just empty. It's so, very sad.
Well, the touching part to me was the note apparently from the kid.
That says, "I miss you. Dear Dad, yep. How are you? School is finally over. We are moving and going to, is it Wisconsin? Sorry, I can't read the little young person's handwriting."
So, but I'm assuming anyway. That's a sketch of his child, and then that for to receive that from your child.
Oh yeah, and the kid is holding someone's hand, and the outline of Dad is like dotted lines. It's very sad. That it is. It's a pretty crappy system that we have, Larry. And then moving right along, are you ready to go on?
Sure.
Okay.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747 227 4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
I think we're at the Georgia case now.
Yep, that's where we are.
Cool. This is a whole list of questions that we put together regarding the thing that happened in Butts County a couple years back where they were putting signs in the people's yards to tell them to don't trick or treat here and whatnot. And that went to court. And then there was what was the thing where they accepted the two parties? I can't remember what that's called, Larry. Can you remind me real quick?
Don't know what you're talking about.
Summary judgment, I think, right? No?
Yep.
Okay. So I will begin reading. You people put this 64-page brief in there, and actually, Larry, I read a lot of it. In the folder, it has to do with challenge Narsal filed against Butts County Sheriff in Georgia, and I thought you said this case was settled, and that's kind of where I kind of remember us leaving off with this.
So, well, it got confusing because there was actually two cases filed in Georgia. They were filed in Butts County and Spalding County, and they were two adjoining counties in the central part, north central part of Georgia. And the Spalding County case actually settled, but the Butts County sheriff vowed that he had put his hand on the Bible and that he would take this all the way to Supreme Court. So that's the one that we're still in court litigating.
Now that you did confuse me because of the two different cases, I thought the judge granted an injunction in the Butts County case, which prohibited the sheriff from imposing this requirement. Let me back up a little bit here. Is this law in Georgia, or by what authority do the two sheriffs require the signs to be posted?
That's the whole basis of the, you're correct, that's the whole basis. We did get an injunction in 2019 in the Spalding County sheriff decided that voluntarily not to erect the signs. But the Butts County sheriff insisted on a fight. So we did get the injunction that prohibited the displaying of signs in 2019 for that Halloween. And the court presumed that the case would be resolved by the time Halloween rolled around in 2020. And in fact, it was. The court ruled in favor of the defendants. And that's the basis for why we're appealing. The county defendants won.
And this happened in the U.S. Court of Appeals?
Yes, we're up on appeal now at the 11th Circuit Court, which is based in Atlanta, and we filed a brief last week, and then the amicus briefs will be coming in this week. I'm working on an amicus. I'm involved on both sides of it. The appellate brief by the attorney that we retained, that brief was filed Wednesday. Then a week later, the amicus briefs are due. So Narsal, in conjunction with Axel, are filing an amicus brief. So I'm involved in that as well. So we are at the Court of Appeals.
Okay. And remind me, the Court of Appeals, there is 1, 2, 5, 10, how many steps below the Supreme Court?
It is just one step below the Supreme Court.
All right. I went to the trial that was here, that was held. It was in the Macon, Georgia area. And did this come up on a second trial? Did I miss something?
You did not miss anything. What you went to was the injunction hearing. And all right. you were sitting in the courtroom. But then after the injunction was granted to protect the parties during that Halloween of 2019, then the next process would be for the case to proceed to trial. So the court confers with the party's counsel and says, where are we going with this? And in this case, both parties decided that they were going to move for summary judgment, and they did.
I've heard you rail against summary judgments. You dislike them greatly. I've heard you say on multiple occasions that you just don't want to do that. You want, we can walk back to the case, Alaska, the Smith versus Doe. That, if I'm not mistaken, that was summary judgment. And, so in this case, it was not clear, like, the signs, were they on private property or were they in the public right of way? There were a whole bunch of questions that weren't answered. If, was it permissible that the sheriff be allowed to do this?
Does it include signs that make a sheriff happy? Right-of-way land is still owned by the person, and the usage is very limited. Those two issues. Oh, I'm answering your question. Darn it, man. Sorry, I flew off the script a little bit.
Yes, it was decided by summary judgment, and I do rant and rave about summary judgment because what happens is when you're litigating a case and you're trying to decide how to get resolution, the lawyers will come tell you one thing, and I'm telling you the whole story. The lawyers will tell you that they do this because it's the right thing to do to resolve the claims quickly. What they leave out is that preparing for a trial is an awful lot of work and an awful lot of expense, and it's going to delay the resolution of the case. So they file for summary judgment when they shouldn't. And I have no objection to summary judgment when it's appropriate, but that's when there are no facts in dispute. In this case, there were facts in dispute.
The facts in dispute were
the signs on public right of way, as the sheriff asserted. We don't know that. And if they were on public right of way, what is the permissible use of that right of way? We don't know that. Does it include signs that make the sheriff happy, or does it include only utility easements and traffic control signs? We would have needed experts to testify on all those things, because the right-of-way is still owned by the private party who owns the property. And these issues would have been more appropriately fully developed at a trial. But we didn't have a trial because we moved for summary judgment.
I was reading through the brief, and it's not just as simple as the easement is 10 feet past something. It's not nearly that simple, because maybe they put the water line 20 feet in instead of 10 feet in. Did they do any sort of land surveys of where the easement ends on each individual's property? They didn't mark where they placed the signs. There were a whole bunch of other things that were going on in the case that could have been swayed in our favor that would have just made it a slam dunk, it seems to me.
That is my concern. Now, since I'm not licensed to practice law, and I don't have the horrendous overhead that these lawyers have, and I think the last count I got, they said that they've got about $500,000 worth of billable hours. Now, of course, that is trying to maximize your billable hours, but this case has now been going on since 2019, so we've gone through quite a lot of activity for this time. And when you have a high-dollar office in downtown Atlanta, you have considerable expenses, and there's a lot of hours involved in this case. And so it's easy for me to say what you should do. But the reality is that's one of the things that holds us back, is that we end up trying to take these shortcuts because of funding issues. We've had attorneys approach us, say that they're going to bring down the registry if we'll give them $100,000 in their nest egg so that they won't have to be worried about out-of-pocket cost. We wouldn't be able to write very many $100,000 checks before we'd be out of business, because that's how little funding we have. So we weren't able to write a $100,000 check. But even if we did, if they're into it for $500,000 of billable hours already, you would see that would have already been extinguished. So that's one incentive for summary judgment. You want to get a resolution, and then you want to be able to file your petition for attorney's fees, which are recoverable in a 1983 action, and that's what they're hoping for.
And just to clarify a point, I guess the reason why you would use a summary judgment is, I think the term would be judicial economy. I think we talked about when we were going to file that Georgia case of bringing everything similar to a class action, where we would like kind of sue all of the courts, all of the counties in the state under one big, not class action, but similar. And that would make it just easier for them to do one judgment instead of 158. Is it here? 159.
Yep.
Isn't that a reason why you would use a summary judgment, is just to like, hey, we just agree. Can the judge rule it? No trial, no jury, no all the extra overhead.
It does aid in judicial economy, but there have to be no facts in dispute. Now, in that particular instance, that you're citing, judicial economy would have been that we had a number of Superior Court judges that, despite the Georgia law that said that a person after 2 years of active supervision, if they had done certain things, that they would be automatically converted to unsupervised to administrative probation. And those judges had invented by judicial fiat something that wasn't in Georgia statute. So we were trying to figure out how to subject all the Superior Court judges who had issued such orders without having to do one by one what we could file. But in the meantime, the Georgia legislature changed the rules of, of the game, which is exactly what we figured they would do.
I guess we could make a somewhat of a comparison. Judges don't write laws, neither do sheriffs.
That is correct. And that's the whole basis for this appeal, is that
good.
There is no Georgia law. And that's what the attorney's argued. He's argued the district court, which the trial judge, Judge Treadway, I believe his name is, he erred and granted the appellee's motion for summary judgment and denying appellant's motion because it misapplied the Supreme Court's standards for determining whether appellee's signs were compelled speech. And that's what this whole thing, our biggest argument is compelled speech. And our attorney's argument, regardless of whether a citizen endorses a message, forcing her to host or respond to a message, which the signs were, with which she disagrees, violates her autonomy over what she chooses to say or not say. The signs deprived appellants of their autonomy to determine what they would and would not say on their own property. And then he goes on to say, no court has ever found such government-dictated expression to be constitutionally tolerable. So that's what this is all about, folks. The sheriff of Butts County decided that he, Gary Long, was going to force people to not engage in any decorations or any handing out of candy or any enjoyment of Halloween because he felt like that was the good thing to do for his community. And he was going to force the people who were on the list of registrants in his county to convey that message to the entire, well, whoever happens to see the signs, that was his prerogative to do that. And that is not his prerogative. We felt strongly about that. Just like the driver's license conveying that you're PFR, we feel equally strong about the states who require you to convey that message. And thankfully, the courts are beginning to agree.
You have something there at the end of that block that says, but nonetheless compelled to host it, which triggers strict scrutiny. Would you dig around that for a minute?
Yes, we're arguing, our attorneys are arguing that this should be reviewed under strict scrutiny rather than the most relaxed standard, which is so low that just anything qualifies.
And strict basis, scrutiny. Right?
Yeah, then there's intermediate scrutiny. So we're arguing that this requires, since it's First Amendment, strict scrutiny, that compelling a person to speak. Obviously, you can compel people to speak. We do that in a number of circumstances, and we've done that all throughout the ages. Back during times of epidemics, we compelled people to announce to the public that their house was under quarantine. We compel people in some states, ours included, that if they have convicted of a DWI, that they have to have a specially DWI interlock and their license is so noted. I mean, but you cannot just compel people to speak without a very narrowly tailored. In the case of DWI, it's narrowly tailored. You went out, you did this, and you're still being punished for your offense. Many people on the sexual offense registry have long since completed their punishment, and there's no unique and narrow tailoring to this. And the case with the signs that were posted on people's houses back in, and I brought this up to the attorneys. He said, "Well, Larry, can you think of a situation where people are forced to speak or have been?" I said, "I can think of dozens of them." And I said, "It's an example that we." I said, "But those people had due process. They were determined to have a contagious disease that put the public at risk if there was any contact with them. That is a justifiable use of compelling a person to speak because otherwise you might not know, and you might become infected and spread that infection. That's different than being on the PFR list."
Sure. Sure. I mean, I don't think it would be a stretch if someone had abducted a child on Halloween that person would be narrowly tailored to have a sign in the yard saying, "Don't trick or treat here."
I think that would be fairly narrowly tailored, and I think that would probably survive the test of what you could do in strict scrutiny. But it has to be the most strict scrutiny requires the most narrow tailoring of a compelling governmental interest. There's no narrow tailoring here. If everybody in his county was required to do that.
Yeah, 50, so 50, Sheriff 56, Long, something like that, people.
Sheriff Long, if you're listening, You need to learn to narrowly tailor these things, and you might get away with them.
Moving along, where will the will there be amicus briefs filed as well?
Absolutely. The my understanding is that the ACLU of Georgia is going to file. I will not be involved in that. And my understanding is that AXL, the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws, is taking the lead, and we will be signing on with them, which our input will be that we will say, gee, this looks pretty good. Thank you for your assistance, and we will be signing on. I will have just very modest involvement in that. I'll get to be the grunt who actually produces the printed copies and transmits them to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Outstanding. Anything else? I find this, the First Amendment stuff, I find it to be super interesting in regards to, like, your license plate. I kind of think you don't own your license plate. You go register and you pay for the privilege to have that on your car so you can then go drive around. So the government can't force you to put their message there too, beyond whatever would be necessary to identify the vehicle itself. To me, it sounds similar to that. And so then posting some other kind of sign in front of your yard that says things about you seems problematic.
That is one of the cases that's cited, the Live Free or Die, New Hampshire, or whoever it was but we're looking forward to this case. We hope we win, of course, because we've put a lot of energy into it, but you never know what the courts are going to decide.
If you want to find the appellate, whatever, submission, what's the right word? It is a brief.
It's the opening brief, yes.
Okay, it'll be in the show notes over at registrymatters.co. Larry, we're going to cover a few articles that we haven't done in quite some time, and we have 10-ish minutes to do it. And do we have anything else before we get to this?
Yeah, let's skip the first one. That's going to take too much time.
All right. So, and then we will move over to one from Newsweek that says, Washington State Supreme Court rules drug possession law unconstitutional in 5-4 decisions. This out of Washington State. Why did you put this here?
Well, there are those who mistakenly believe that sexual offenses are the only thing that are strict liability offenses. And that's just simply not true. And I put this in here because it gives me a chance to bash the Democrat Party.
Oh, God, here we go again. Why are you such a Republican?
So I get accused of being partisan. And I keep saying it's all about policy. Now, this is an example of the courts have provided the Washington State Legislature all the cover that they need. But the problem is it calls thousands of convictions into doubt because the law was unconstitutional. And they don't want to have to go through and undo thousands of convictions. So what they want to do is to try to make something that's unconstitutional constitutional. So a Democrat lawmaker has proposed a rewrite of the unconstitutional law to salvage it. So, okay, I'm not any more happy about a Democrat lawmaker if it had been a Republican lawmaker. So therefore, put this down on your list that Larry said that he was unhappy about a proposal to salvage a bad law. It's unconstitutional. You have the cover. Let it go. Let's unravel these convictions. It's going to take some time. Let's get these people back to paying taxes and working, and let go of it, for Christ's sakes. Let go of these people.
Do me a favor, and could you expand on how strict liability applies here?
It's when you don't have the knowledge that they were, in fact, drugs.
Okay. They're my mom's, they're my kids, and I'm borrowing their car.
Yep, any number of things. Okay. Let me make sure we call out this guy by name that proposed this. Democratic State Senator Mark Mullett called the court's decision, an overreach. He has entered a new drug possession law that explicitly mentions knowing intent. Now, I haven't read the proposal. It might be that it contours to constitutionality, but just let these people go. You had a bad law for all these years, and get over it. So,
I think it seems that hyper generalizing, Team Red is in certain respects is a little bit more like do what you want to do in certain respects. I don't know that it's necessary in this particular camp.
Oh, not in this case. He'll have plenty of Republican support if there are any Republicans in Washington still left, because they're part of the law enforcement industrial complex. But but I'm just disappointed that it would be. I would expect it to be introduced by a Republican, and I would expect the Democrats to be vilified for not supporting it by the Republicans. But I'm always disappointed when it's a Democrat that takes the lead. But they need to be called out, and they're being called out. Just like I've called out Democrats so many times before.
I'm wondering, I don't see anywhere in this article which justices voted which way. Just curious on how that went down. I'm trying to look real quick to see if I see any of the Supreme Court justices' names, but I don't see anybody. All right. Interesting. I would like to know. I'm always curious about how they voted by which president nominated them and whatnot.
These are state Supreme Court, so it won't matter. You don't have any presidents.
Never mind. Then I wouldn't know them anyway. The next one comes from the Collateral Consequences Resource Center, which is really a total mouthful to say. President Biden orders Department of Justice to facilitate voting for people in federal custody or under supervision. That's kind of neat because we've talked about the logistics of trying to bring in ballots for people, setting up how, like, it would be very challenging. Should be done, but very challenging for people that are in custody. I guess that would be pretrial.
There'd be people who in federal custody that would be eligible to vote in some state laws. There are states where you're not disenfranchised. But only put this in here just to point out that those of you who claim that you're for criminal justice reform and you have a hard time acknowledging when the Democrat Party does something good, here is an example of the Democrat Party putting forth something that potentially is very good. They've put a copy. I put a link to the executive order, and the fact that it won't restore voting rights to a lot of people because you have to be eligible under state law. But at least if you are eligible under the state law, that you're incarcerated or on supervision or whatever, this is a directive to help facilitate the voting of those people. That is a positive step, and I'm going to commend President Biden for doing that, just as I'd be criticizing him if he did something that was contrary to what he ran on, which was criminal justice. One of the things was criminal justice reform.
I would like to read the opening line here on purpose number one. It says, "The right to vote is a foundation of American democracy. Free and fair elections that reflect the will of the people must be protected and defended." That's cool. I have a hard time disagreeing with anything said there, Larry.
So, well, let's watch it and see if they actually get anybody involved in voting.
Sure. I think you're going to call this one funny. This one comes from the San Francisco Chronicle. Old age is not reason enough to release a PFR state court rules. What happened here, Larry?
Well, this is a person, 74 years old, who's in civil commitment. And he had done his best previously to get discharged from civil commitment, which is what anybody in their right mind would do because it's all a hoax. The whole sham of civil commitment after you've done your time is a disgrace to this country's basic moral. I mean, it just defies everything about who we are. But anyway, he had been disappointed that they had not released him on one of his efforts to be discharged from civil commitment. So he
Why, Larry? Why did they deny them?
Well, he had told the judge in that process that he did not like the fact that they were denying his petition for release because he might reoffend. And he said, quote, "Nobody can predict what I might do. Even I can't predict what I might do." So this petition to be released because of COVID was denied, and the court cited to his very words of what he said previously, that no one could predict what he might do, including himself. So this just goes into Larry's general rules. Do not say in a court proceeding with a stenographer typing away and usually an audio recording, do not make statements like that.
There, I made that one on cue the right way. Anything else? And then we can wrap things up here. We're at the final little tidbit here to cover.
That was all I wanted to say was that it's sad that he couldn't get out, but he kind of had his own words used against him. So be careful what you say.
Yep. And then finally, from the appeal, we have an article that says Biden must nominate U.S. attorneys who will implement needed criminal justice reforms. I was glancing through this. I didn't realize that there were 93, I think it says, 93 federal prosecutors. And I'm thinking that we should nominate Larry Krasner. Yes, there are 93 U.S. attorneys. Larry Krasner is the Philadelphia one that's super progressive. I think that would be... You've said repeatedly that the person that can slow down, like put the brakes on it immediately, would be the prosecutors. And this would happen at county, state, and federal levels. If we wanted to slow down the number of people in prison, is to have prosecutors that don't prosecute as hard.
That is correct. And as we're beginning to launch this administration, we're not launching it, but as it's being launched, one of the things that's one of the important things, we hear a lot about judicial appointments. It's also very important about the U.S. attorney's offices around the country. Normally, they're asked for their resignation because they're holdover appointees from the previous administration. Some are reappointed and some are not. But if you're serious, President Biden, about criminal justice reform, you've got to take a little political heat, like Obama did, and appoint people that will actually issue orders that will undo what the previous Department of Justice did, which was to seek the maximum penalties and to throw the book at everybody. And you're going to have to do that. These people are going to have to be serious about that. And we'll be watching and we will be criticizing you if you don't do that, because that's what you ran on. And we will hold you out to the public saying that you ran and you are not doing what you said, just as I said about the vice president. I'm hoping that she had that epiphany and that was a real epiphany, and that she actually does support reforms and stop locking everybody up. That's not what she did when she was attorney general. So we have to wait and see. But these are very important appointments that are going to be made, and we'll see how they operate. But Jeff Sessions, one of the first things he did is instructed all 93 of those to seek maximum penalties and all the enhancements.
Correct.
And Obama had undone that by saying to not seek enhancements, don't file the highest possible charge. And those things affect how long and how many people go to prison.
There's a clip, one of the bullet points. Biden has pledged to scale back mass incarceration and address the racial, gender, and income disparities in the criminal justice system. U.S. attorneys are responsible for many of the decisions that led to those problems and will be essential to fixing them. I guess that's probably comments more so from the appeal. But yeah, that, I don't know why we lock people up for so long, Larry, other than it's what we've always done. So it should be what we continue to do. And it would be someone stepping out, potentially taking a risk to do it less. And then, quote unquote, the tidal wave of criminality that you often reference.
Actually, we have not always done that. It's really been since the decade of the 80s that we cracked down on crime. But there was a time when the federal prison operated on a medical model that they believed that crime was based on something could be treated, and the goal was to rehabilitate people. But for decades now, we've believed in this very tough lock them up. And the conservatives will tell you that it's worked. They will tell you that the reason why crime is down is because this toughness that they have advocated for has been successful. And you have to give them some concession. As they locked up more and more people for longer and longer periods of time, crime rates have gone down precipitously.
Sure. I remember when we were covering Larry Krasner that he said to his prosecutors that if they're going to spend more than, I think it was 3 years, to write him, quote unquote, an IOU, to say it was 40 grand a year, whatever the number was that they're using, 40, 50 grand a year. So if you're going to put a person in prison for 10 years, you're going to write me an IOU for 50,000 times 10. So $500,000, that's what the person's crime is worth the state for putting them in prison for 10 years. Like for 500 grand, you better, God, there's so much other stuff. The person loses income. It's just a mess. I hate it.
So, well, I would like to try experimenting using that money with the offender, a portion of that, to see if we can actually train them to, but see, that's too liberal pointy head. We can't do that.
I understand. I think that makes a lot of sense. Do something to put some of that money back into helping the person not continue to have a criminal lifestyle. I think that sounds like an amazing idea. I vote you to run for the next politician that can do these things. There.
So
I did it. Anybody else want to second me?
So, well, we got to get out. Anything else, Larry?
We do. We are. 108.
How do people contact us?
Of course, we're going to run right to contact us. Well, you want them to send voicemail to 747-227-4477. Write it down. Read it out. Don't but make it short, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and I will damn sure play it on the podcast. You could also reach us over at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You could also find us over at registrymatters.co. You can find a way to contact us there as well. Larry, our Patreon people are the best, and they support us, and they make it worthwhile, and it is a token of the appreciation that they send us a little bit of some money every month, and you can find us there at patreon.com/registrymatters. And Twitter, YouTube, where else? There is a Facebook page. Shh, don't tell anybody. And that's all I got, man.
Well, it's a pleasure joining you again.
And
that is why I am here.
Perfect. We did it awesome. Every time. I love it, Larry. You're the best. I appreciate it. And we will... one other thing. We will not be recording. It'll be April 3rd that we are going to skip. So 2 weeks from tonight, we will not be recording. And otherwise, Larry, bid you adieu. You're the best, and I will talk to you next week. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.